from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories, followed by conversations with Linda. Here's what's happening. Scientists believe they know where the Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 crashed into the ocean and that the cabin sank in one piece. Now, the research by the University of Western Australia using meteorological and ocean current data alongside the British analysis from pings recorded by a UK firm apparently has determined the point of impact and the movements of debris in the weeks following the crash. A fresh satellite sighting off 300 floating objects ranging in size from 7 to 49 feet, about 1,700 miles from Perth in the southern Indian Ocean, reported by Thailand. Now, this also ties in with French and Chinese satellites as well. They are sending planes to that region. We'll see what happens. With an estimated 17,000 nuclear weapons in the world, we have the power, of course, to exterminate humanity many times over. But it would not take a full-scale war to make Earth uninhabitable, according to a report. This is what it says. Even a relatively small regional nuclear war, like a conflict between India and Pakistan, could spark a global environmental catastrophe, according to the study. Well, after the stock market's best year since 1997, warning flags are starting to go up on Wall Street, where stock turbulence is on the rise. This year's first quarter ends on Monday, is not nearly as bullish as last year. And Bank of America is paying $6.3 billion to settle a lawsuit arising out of troubled mortgage-backed securities that it cobbled together and sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the run-up to the financial crisis. The bank has agreed to pay the sum to settle a lawsuit filed on behalf of the two government-sponsored mortgage finance firms by the regulator, the Federal Housing Finance Administration. Michael Shedlock-Mish, you're with us, and let's see what you think about this settlement.
Well, that's a pretty big settlement, but how much did they make off of all the illegal activity they did? How much did they hide? And, you know, so that's really what I want to know. And then more importantly, how, with all of these admissions and billions of fines, not one person has been implicated for a criminal investigation. They sweep all of this under the rug with fines. And they sound big, and they are big, but in retrospect, I don't think they were big enough. And then look at what Citigroup wanted to do the other day. We had these stress tests in the United States.
Right.
And everyone passed, of course. A couple of banks didn't, and which is what we talked about in advance. But Citigroup filed a proposal to buy back shares. Here we are after an enormous run-up since 2009, and these financial institutions file plans with the Fed to buy back shares. And they want to do it now while insiders are bailing hand over fist. All you got to do is go to any of the insider information where they have to report what they're doing. Insiders are bailing. So all they're doing is buying back these shares so that insiders can unload at today's lofty prices. It's sickening, George.
We're going to get out of the woods here, Mish, or what?
I don't think so. I really don't. There's just too much stuff going on. China is on the verge of a huge, huge slowdown. That's going to have global repercussions. The situation in Europe certainly isn't settled with Ukraine. Russia's hiking the price of natural gas to Ukraine and Europe. We had a couple of European countries come to the United States to plead before the U.S. Senate, of all places, for the United States to free up its natural gas via liquid natural gas terminals. George, I'm all in favor of that. Far better than sanctions, but it's going to be till 2020 before that hits. Meanwhile, interest rates are starting to rise. Earnings estimates have been disappointing. I just don't see it. I've been wrong, George, but I just don't see the stock market staying this lofty this long, all because the Fed was pumping money and now it's stopping.
All right, we're going to see what happens, Mish, and you'll be right with us all the way. Now, look, if you own a cat, don't panic when you hear this story, but you need to hear it. Two people in England have developed tuberculosis after contact with pet cats in the first ever recorded cases of cat-to-human transmission. Veterinarians believe domestic cats could be catching this disease, maybe from rodents. They're not sure yet, but that's happening. Laws banning smoking in public places have apparently had a positive impact on child health, according to an international study. Researchers found that a 10% reduction in premature births and severe childhood asthma attacks within a year of smoke-free laws being introduced. That's a good sign. Texting and driving, of course, is dangerous, but a new survey finds that talking on a cell phone while behind the wheel may be even worse. The National Safety Council's annual report finds that 26% of all crashes are tied to phone use. Only 5% involved texting. A Minnesota school district has agreed to pay $70,000 to settle a lawsuit that claimed that school officials violated a student's constitutional rights by viewing her Facebook and email accounts without permission. The lawsuit, filed in 2012 by the American Civil Liberties Union, alleged that the now 15-year-old was given detention after posting comments about a teacher's aide on her Facebook page, even though she was at home and not using school computers. The ACLU said the administrators viewed her online conversations between her and a student because apparently they were talking about sex. A parent apparently complained about the Facebook chat. The school called her in and demanded her password, and with a sheriff deputy looking on, the girl, of course, panicked and said, sure. They browsed through her Facebook page in front of her. $70,000. Peter Davenport, of course, heads up the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, give us our weekly update. What's in the skies these days?
Well, good evening, George. And, I listen to these news reports, and people think that UFOs are strange, but there couldn't possibly be anything stranger than what goes on this planet.
That is true.
Boy, but I was hoping to be able to say tonight that the volume of reports had tapered off and it was quieting down, but that was until about an hour ago when the reports started pouring in. But I'd like to go back a couple nights. Tuesday night, that makes it the 25th of March, got a couple very, very interesting reports from up in Alaska, the Kenai Peninsula, which is about 100 miles south of Anchorage or so. Got two reports back-to-back, George, from the cities or villages, I guess I should call them, of Nikiski and Clam Gulch. Yet another of these sightings of a cluster of red or orange lights. We have them posted to our website. If people want to read some really interesting accounts of these red fireball accounts, I would counsel them to go to our website, ufocenter.com. We've link to those two sightings from our homepage, and people can just call them up and read them. But the interesting thing about these cases is we have two groups of independent witnesses, and they both report that the objects were floating towards a fuel refinery. Now, my perception of refineries is they probably have guards on duty to protect the perimeter. And my suspicion is that people at the plant saw these lights coming, and we'd like to get many more reports from people up in that neck of the woods. More recently this morning, a very, very interesting case from Arnold, Maryland, just south of Baltimore. A fireman was getting ready to go to work. It was 0430 hours East Coast time. He was packing his truck with all his gear and supplies, and his peripheral vision picked up a cluster of lights nearby. He thought nothing of it at first because he lives relatively close to Baltimore International Airport. But then once he loaded his gear, he looked over and was flabbergasted to see a triangular craft, he estimated about 40 feet long, with three solid white lights on it and a strobing red light in the belly. We've heard that story how many times, hovering over a nearby row of trees. And I don't mean to pick on Maryland tonight, but two reports have come in just within the last hour. 9 p.m. tonight, a family was driving home to their home in Frederick, which is up north-northeast of the Capitol. And they were flabbergasted to see a cluster of, they estimate, somewhere between four and six triangular craft headed towards Washington, D.C., that is towards the south. And one of them was being pursued at very high speed by two fighters. If they were that close to the Capitol, I'm not surprised that somebody would have been on their tail.
What a great story. Peter.
But a lot going on. And thanks for the airtime tonight.
Always,
George.
My friend. We really appreciate your updates. If you go to our coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the Insta poll under the highlights. We ask you two very important questions. One has to do with, do you believe there's intelligent life in the universe? And then you can answer that in poll number one. And if you believe yes, we ask you another question, whether you believe that intelligent life is visiting here or not. In a moment, Seth Shostak joins us from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Let's get some new updates from Seth on just what they're doing. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. As we also reported yesterday, astronomers have discovered a dwarf planet that's even farther away from Pluto, so far, in fact, that its orbit reaches into a new edge of the solar system. It's not that big, but they're finding more and more. Seth Shostak, of course, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. And here he is, one of our favorite guests back on Coast to Coast. Boy, they're finding these dwarf planets all over the place, Seth.
Well, they are, and the interesting thing about this one is it's so far out. That raises some interesting questions. Not likely about its habitability. It's going to be really cold out there. But the big question is, how the heck do you make a planet that far out? Or if you didn't make it there, how did it get there? So those are some pretty puzzling things.
So, Seth, we've got an Insta poll going on at coasttocoastam.com, and of course, question number one is, do you believe there's intelligent life out there in the universe? I would guess if you were even participating in that poll, you'd say, yes, you believe that. Am I pretty correct there?
Yeah, well, absolutely, yes. And in fact, most people, I think, will believe that. I mean, to some extent, that's because they've seen aliens for a long time on television and in the movies. So the idea is fairly, they're comfortable with that idea. But the other thing is that I think many among the public, I mean, they've seen the news about planets around other stars, and it isn't just one or two anymore. We found thousands. And, I think that is sort of seeped into the public consciousness. So people realize there's a lot of real estate out there, and if there is a lot of real estate out there, maybe some of it is populated.
You said something to me once on Coast to Coast many years ago, I've never forgotten it, that the primordial soup in the universe is the same all over the place. So it's obvious that if you get that planet that is in that great proximity, that habitable zone from its star, and it's got water, the chances are likely it's going to have some kind of life. Now, the big question is, does it develop to intelligent life like us? And I just think that the model, the physics model out there is the same.
Well, that's true. The physics and the chemistry are the same. They're the same throughout the part of the universe we can see. Now, there was this interesting result about a week or two ago that pertained to what happened very shortly after the Big Bang in a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. There was this period of very rapid expansion called inflation. Now, one of the consequences from the kind of inflation that seems to be, indicated by the evidence here, is that it could happen all the time, and there may be other universes, parallel universes, right? Multiple universes. These sorts of models now have a little bit more credibility, okay? And in those other universes, you know, things might not be the same. But, hey, we've got our universe, and as far as we can tell, the most distant galaxies, the most distant stars, all have the same chemistry, all have the same physics. So anything that's happened here could happen there.
Probably no surprises, I would guess.
Well, you know, there are some fairly big unknowns. I mean, if I give you a million worlds that are, you know, pretty close to the Earth, in other words, they're more or less the same size, and you know, they're made of rock and metal and stuff like that, and they've got a liquid ocean or two on the surface, and they have some atmosphere. I'd give you a million of those and just let them sit there and do their thing for, you know, a couple of billion years. How many of them will cook up life, and how many of those will cook up intelligent life? And you might say, well, all the conditions are there for that to happen, but that doesn't mean that it will happen. There are a lot of, you know, forks in the road to the development of us, and maybe those forks are, you know, fairly seldom taken in the right direction to produce something like us.
Seth, give us some updates. What's going on at SETI?
Well, I think actually the most interesting things in SETI these days are the fact that the landscape is kind of changing thanks to all the work of the astronomers who are finding all these planets. Now, you know, the big planet success is due to the Kepler telescope, NASA's Kepler telescope, which is out there. It's actually not working terribly well for finding planets anymore because it lost one of its gyroscopes, if you will, one of its reaction wheels, as they're called, about 6 months ago or something like that. And that means you can't use it for collecting new data of the type that it was able to collect for the first 4 years. But they're still reducing those data. They're still analyzing those data from the first 4 years. So now Kepler has found, you know, I mean, the number of planets is many, many hundreds. It's really thousands. And the interesting thing is that if you look at those data kind of carefully, you can sort of guess, well, not guess, but you can sort of estimate that the fraction of stars that have planets that are in that habitable zone you mentioned where, you know, water is neither frozen or boiling might be as many as 1 in 5. 1 in 5 stars might have a planet where you could have life. And that's a very high number. So that means that if you're doing SETI, you know, you can essentially look at any star. As long as you look at enough of them, you're going to have plenty that are habitable.
We're assuming, of course, that their technology advanced at the same kind of pace that ours did in terms of radio transmissions and the like. Is that a pretty good assumption?
Well, of course, we're not going to know until we find another example.
Right.
I mean, we've got ourselves. We might have been fast. We might have been slow. And we're not going to know because we're, you know, we're the only intelligent species we know about. I mean, but look at the time scale. Earth was born about 4.5 billion years ago. And it didn't take very long for life to spring up. I mean, as soon as the Earth kind of cooled down a bit, certainly within the first billion years, but probably faster than that, there was already life. So, you know, the Earth was still young, and it was already getting coated, if you will, with all this life. But that life remained microscopic. It was single-celled organisms for billions of years, right? And you think, oh, that's kind of boring. Well, it's not boring if you're one of these people who study these microorganisms, because they're very complex, actually. But, you know, that's not intelligent life. And then there is 500, 600 million years of, you know, more complex things like trilobites and snakes and dinosaurs and birds and all that stuff. And only in the last 200,000 years have you gotten Homo sapiens. And for most of that, not much happened. Only in the very last sliver you get science and technology and suddenly something that could build a radio transmitter so that we could hear them, or a rocket so they could go somewhere. So you can say, yeah, maybe there's a lot of life out there, but how much of it is intelligence? You know, we just don't know.
We don't know. Seth, still making speaking engagements and getting great interest in SETI?
Well, there is a lot of interest in SETI. I have to say, that is a very gratifying thing, George, that people,
sure is.
People really are interested in this thing. Yes, yes, they are.
Stay with us, Seth. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take some phone calls with you. Seth's website, of course, SETI.org, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And if you haven't participated in the poll, please go ahead and do that. We're going to talk about poll number 2 when we come back, along with some of your phone calls. But vote in go to poll 1 first, If you vote yes, then move on to poll number two. And then you can take a look at the results and have some fun with it. It's right on the homepage at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. And, of course, the second half of our poll, our Insta poll, is after we've asked you the question whether you believe there's intelligent life in the universe, the second question is if you believe there is, are they visiting us now or have they in the past? Seth, we've talked with you before. We had a debate with Stanton Friedman about this as well. Let me ask you before we go to calls, because, you know, you like so many of us, believe that there is life in the universe, why do you hold back in terms of it has come to visit us at this point?
Well, yeah, I noticed the poll results there, George. It looks
I
like
know.
96% of people believe that, you know, they're out there, but roughly 90% of them think that they might be here or might have been here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you phrase the question that way, they might have been here. I mean, I can't really disagree with that because, doggone it, who's to say that they didn't visit the trilobites or something like that, and they just didn't leave any evidence that we could find. But my real concern about the claims that we're being visited now is that the evidence is just not very convincing, not to me anyhow, and I get plenty of it. People send me photos and videos every day. So I do see a lot of it, but, you know, none of it is good enough to put in the museums, and none of it is the kind of stuff that I think that many of my science colleagues would look at for very long. And it's not because they're closed-minded. A lot of people like to think that. Maybe some of them are. I don't know. They're human, after all. But I don't think it's because they're closed-minded. I think that the evidence just has to be a whole lot stronger if you're going to make that case.
Now, in terms of technology out at SETI, what are you folks using now?
Well, we use the Allen Telescope Array. That's what the SETI Institute has. As you know, SETI is a very small endeavor, so there isn't a whole heck of a lot of instrumentation you can use because you just can't afford to use
right.
more than one instrument. So we use our array. It's 42 antennas in Northern California up in the Cascade Mountains, and we've been looking at the center of our galaxy. We look at a lot of nearby stars. I'm making a pitch to have us look at red dwarf stars. These are little runts of the
mm-hmm.
universe, but there are a lot of them. So on average, they're closer, and it looks like a lot of them might have planets that could be okay for ET. So, you know, that's the kind of thing we look at. But, you know, there are other projects out there. There's some really interesting ideas coming along for SETI. Some of them involve building really giant optical telescopes, you know, telescopes with mirrors. There's one project called the Colossus Project. Sounds like a science fiction movie, actually. The Colossus Project, they want to build a telescope where the mirror diameter is, I think, 74 meters. So, you know, 160, 170 feet in diameter. That's a big mirror. But the idea is to look at planets around other stars and see if you can see, you know, too much waste heat coming from one of those planets, because that might be a tip-off that there's a really advanced society there, you know, burning through a lot of energy because they have a high standard of living. Those kinds of approaches which have never been taken before.
There are probably millions of advanced civilizations out there somewhere.
Well, I you know, nobody knows the number, of course. Finding one would be good for me, but millions is probably not too extravagant given the size of the universe. Every galaxy out there on average is going to have something like a trillion. Now, that's with a T, a trillion planets. And most of them are going to be, you know, dead losses, but not all of them. And if only one in a million of those planets has some interesting life forms on it, then that's still a million societies
Easy.
Per galaxy that have sprung up. And since there are 150 billion galaxies, well, you do the math. These are huge numbers.
You can't do it. It's too big. It really is. Let's go to Paul in Miami, Florida, to get things started here. Paul, you're on with Seth Shostak. Go ahead.
Hello.
Howdy.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. Your screener asked my age. I'm 78 years old. And I just want to ask you this question, you and your guests, and Art. I appreciated listening to Art years ago. Anyway, my question is, if I had the ability, or anybody, to take off from the Earth and go straight up, whether it's day or night, go straight up, would you ever come to, I mean, up in the universe, up in the sky, would you ever come to an end, a wall or something that would stop you?
Well, you know what? Yeah. That's not a far-fetched question, Paul, that I have asked a lot of guests, like, what is at the end of the universe? And it just doesn't end, Seth, does it?
No, it doesn't. Paul, you know, it is a good question. And it, and the answer is one of those answers that's kind of unsatisfying because it's not very intuitive. But exactly what George said, you're not going to come to another, you know, you're not going to come to the end of it. But on the other hand, you could say if you started walking on the earth, you know, I mean, leave aside the problem of walking on water. You have to do something about that. But, you know, you're not going to come to a wall, end of earth. You're not. You can just walk as much as you want. And that's because, you know, the earth is curved. But you don't see that when you're standing in your backyard. You don't notice the earth is curved. That could be a model for the universe, for example, that, you know, it looks flat. It looks like you could just go straight. But although you think you're going straight, you're actually going around a big curve, if you will. Now, that's a bit simplified, but as far as we know, the universe is unbounded. That is, you're never going to come to a wall that says last gasp before the end of the universe.
Very well said. Bob, truck driving in Texas, first-time caller. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
How you doing? I've loved this show for
20-plus
years.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to answer your poll real quick. There has to be intelligent life out there because there ain't much here. I hope to God they're visiting because that'll give me some other people to talk to besides y'all. But at the same time, I would not have any clue why they'd want to come down and visit.
Well, that's a $64,000 question. Go ahead, Seth.
Yeah, well, that is a good question, Bob. And in fact, a lot of people have been asking me that question over the course of the last 48 hours because I was down in Los Angeles talking to some movie people. And that's a question they wrestle with all the time.
You didn't look us up? We're right here, Seth.
Well, I don't know. I was,
next
was there
time.
In Hollywood.
Next
yeah,
time.
Well, I should have looked you up. But in any case, that's a story problem for them. If the aliens come here, they've got to have a good reason. And what is the good reason? Why would they come here, Bob? And you're suggesting you don't think they have any good reason to come here. And it actually is hard to think of anything we've got that they haven't got at home. But what we have that they don't have at home, of course, is, you know, all the life here. That's, you know, if they're into biology, you know, or they collect plants like little E.T., then there might be a reason to come here. Other reasons to come here would be just to enjoy the music. Who knows? There are very few things that we have that they don't have at home, and they could save the shipping charges. So it actually is hard to think of why they'd come here.
Would you be surprised, Seth, if there was intelligent life on Mars and they got obliterated? They got to the point where their technology might have been just like ours. Maybe we are the Martians, but something catastrophic obviously happened to that planet, wiped out its atmosphere, and they're gone.
Well, that may have happened. I mean, there may have been Martians. In fact, I think that a lot of scientists would say that's a pretty reasonable proposition, that there once was life on Mars. There may still be life on Mars, but maybe there was life on Mars that's gone now. But it wouldn't have been, you know, a vast civilization. I think that's a much harder thing to swallow, because if you look at Mars, it's a desert, right? Now imagine that we were to obliterate ourselves here on Earth, okay? And then you looked at the Earth, 100 million years from now or a billion years from now. Do you think you would still see evidence that we were here? Well, you betcha. I mean, you would see all sorts of stuff. It wouldn't be in working order or any of it, but you would still see everywhere. You would see the remains of highways and buildings and aluminum tab tops and all sorts of stuff that just isn't going to go away for a very long time.
It'll be crumbled, but at least you'll be able to say, hey, that's not natural.
Exactly. Yeah, you would see, yes, you would see these straight highways crossing.
The potholes would be unbelievable.
I think Mars has never seen that kind of civilization.
Let's go to Sue in Dayton, Ohio on the wild card line. Sue, hello.
Oh, George, you know you kick butt over Art Bell. Oops, that's really bad to say, but it's true.
Yeah, don't say that.
Thank you so much.
Don't say that.
Mr.
The clouds will
open
and lightning will hit me.
Well, That's not going to happen. I promise that. I'll watch over you. Dr. Shostak, I've been a follower of your research for a good while, and I'm very honored to speak with you. My background's in biological sciences. At one point, I wanted to go into theoretical biology. After my studies, I realized, and I was kind of disheartened about it, the great amount of variables that took place on our Earth to initiate the first life. And that was the template for all which other lives have been based. All the different extinctions which took place over this vast period of time, which produced the life forms that we currently have. I look at space now, not discounting that there couldn't be life, but the life that I believe is in space, and that's a leap of faith, I believe, would be so vastly different, even if our Earth were repeated the same exact conditions a million times, one would never see the life forms that we have now.
Yeah, well, Sue, that's absolutely true. And that was a point that Stephen Jay Gould, the Harvard evolutionary biologist, used to like to make. He would say, if you could rewind the tapes of life's history on Earth and play them again with, you know, an extra thunderstorm 100 million years ago, or who knows what, you know, the results would be quite different. A very obvious example of that, if that rock that landed in the Yucatan 65 million years ago
That's
had
right.
arrived, you know, a half a day earlier, we'd have dinosaurs in California rather than people. So it's certainly true what you say, that the history would be different. But the question is, yes, they're going to look different in the whole, you know, the biological record will be different. Their museums will have different collections and all that. But would any of those planets eventually produce the functional equivalent of us? In other words, some sort of critter that was clever enough to eventually figure out the laws of science and some engineering and build stuff and maybe eventually make a radio transmitter for us so that we could hear them with our SETI experiments. That's the question, and that's a much harder one to answer.
And Seth, let's add in for just a second the God equation into this. Is it conceivable that there will be life on these other planets and they'll evolve, but they just won't be like us because of the God factor, that makes us so special, so unique, that, you know, we may get to the ape form on some planet, but in terms of our kind of intelligence, this is where it stops? Or will that God factor be prevalent throughout the universe?
Well, that's one for the theologians, George.
I know.
I don't know the answer to that. All I would say is this. You know, if we are really special in the sense that we're not, you know, that we really are God's children, but we are the only children of God, if you will, that God hasn't done this anywhere else, then that makes us very, very special. And, you know, when you look at how vast the universe is and how many stars and planets and all that stuff, and by the way, 2 weeks ago it may have gotten a lot bigger if we really had parallel universes and things like that.
Yeah, and we may.
Yeah, I mean, this may be nothing. The whole universe may be just a single drop of water in an ocean. If any of that is true, and a lot of it is true, then making us so special doesn't quite smell right, if you know what I mean. It means, once again, we're sitting around figuring, hey, we are it. And I think that's the result of, you know, having loving parents who tell you for the first 20 years of your life, you're really special. And as a consequence, you know, you can carry on that attitude. In science, it turns out that there doesn't seem to be anything particularly special about where we are in the universe, or even the fact that we're on a planet with water or anything like that. So if we want to insist that, well, that's okay, because biologically or mentally or ethically or morally, we're very special. I mean, you can say that, but I would be careful. That's what the Greeks called hubris.
Well, that's a good point. And look, I'm a believer that with this incredible universe that we occupy, and whatever created it, there's some intelligence behind it. This is not a roll of the dice. It's not all luck. There's order throughout the universe. I mean, the laws of physics, whoever created them, was an absolute genius. There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, it's true that they work. They work for us. But, you know, if you're a physicist, you're not really happy with that explanation. it's really tough to, you know, try and explain why all the constants of physics, the numbers that define how strong gravity is and so forth and so on, to come out and say, well, you know, these were just set up by God so that we could be here. I mean, that's one answer, but you're not going to get that answer published in the physical review letters or anything like that.
I know.
Yeah, so you look for, well, are there any other possibilities that are sort of more naturalistic? And one such possibility is that there are, you know, gazillions of universes out there, for example, to once again seize on this multi-universe idea. But if you have, you know, just lots and lots and lots of universes, if they're being made all the time, then you can say, well, each one, you know, just has a random assembly of constants, and, you know, in this universe they only have two dimensions, and that universe they have six and whatever, and the one we're in has three spatial dimensions and so forth, and it turns out that works. So most of these universes won't work, but of course the guys who are sitting around late at night talking about it are in one of the universes that does work, and it wasn't a miracle. It's just that if you buy a gazillion lottery tickets, some of them are going to be good.
Yeah, but the ones I buy never are.
Well, you just need to buy a gazillion.
Let's go to Tom in Billings, Montana. Squeeze you in here, Thomas. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I've seen aliens. I assume that they work for NASA because I saw them at Houston Continental Airport on two or three separate occasions.
What do they look like?
They look like people that don't have much hair, and they wear Smokey the Bear hats. And
how do you know they were who they were?
Because they didn't have any hair on them at all, and if you thought, if you said something to them by thinking, they would hear what you were saying. And for one of the flight attendants that on the airplane I was on, I told her about who was on board, and
what she said.
And she said she was traveling home over to Florida, and that's usually where they go from Houston.
That's smart.
And she said, "I know who you are, and if you can hear me, turn around right now and look at me." And they did. And they were 10 rows ahead of her. She about fainted.
That is strange. Hey, you never know. You never know. Seth, if folks want more information on SETI, I assume they can simply go to the website.
They can. They can. We're very accessible. We try and answer people's questions. We try and give them as much information as we can.
All right, Seth, thanks so much for being on the program.
It's always a pleasure, George. Thank you.
Seth Shostak. Now, the poll is still active and will be throughout the night. So if you haven't voted yet or haven't picked, go ahead and do it. It's poll number one. You got to go through two polls. And if you say yes to poll number one, then move on to poll number two. And those results, of course, I don't think they'll startle you. They are pretty in line with what I expected. In a moment, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us. She's got lots of stories she went out to cover. She'll report them back to you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.